Ladies, we're going to get started. 2 o'clock. Okay. So before we start with the content, are there any administrative questions left over? Everybody's clear on the term, certification, exams. There is still somebody, we have an exam to return that didn't get picked up, so, and the person's here, or at least. Did anybody say they were leaving? Does anybody know who's not here? I'll do a quick, I know there are some people who left their stuff and hopefully are coming back, although it wouldn't be the first time. Somebody actually went when you left the building and couldn't get back in. Oh. And locked behind us.
Oh, no.
And they had all their stuff and they went and called us and told us to save their stuff. So we got 3, 6, 7, 8, 9. So, yeah, we have... I'll do a quick roll after it looks like everybody's here. So, no questions. And Jim picked some people to do consultation next month. Okay, good. All right. So I'm start out today by talking about specific phobia. And the reason we start with, I like to talk about this is not that this is the most common type of anxiety disorder that you're going to be treating, but because the base, it's more straightforward than a lot of the other anxiety disorders, and so it sets the groundwork for the other anxiety disorders in a little more straightforward way. So if you look on page 11, the criteria are, a marked fear or anxiety about a specific object or situation. And by the way, I'm sure I'll slip up and call it simple phobia because that's what it was for years. It's now specific phobia, and so old habits die hard. But I never liked the term simple phobia because it made it seem like it should be no big deal. And I mean, if you're the one who's dealing with it, I don't know. It seemed like probably why they changed it is because it seems like it's discounting the concern. So a person has a marked fear or anxiety about a specific object or a situation. And either exposure to the stimulus always or almost always provokes fear or anxiety, or the person actively avoids or endures it with a lot of anxiety. And it needs to interfere significantly with the person's life and be out of proportion to the actual rational danger and to the socioeconomic context. So it's an interesting one because you can have the exact same concerns and if just the situation changes, you can move from non-clinical to clinical. So for example, I once had a secretary who was afraid of heights. And she just built her life around. She lived on the first floor. She worked on the first floor. And it wasn't, she did have a distinct fear of heights, but it did not interfere significantly with her life, and she was fine with it. And then her building went condo, and so she had to move to the 16th floor. And that was the only thing that changed. And all of a sudden, this became a phobia. So it's and people will come in. I remember one guy, he came in. You can tell a lot about what people call with, but one guy called up and he said he had a fear, one fear, and his fear was of swimming out far into the ocean all by himself. And, it just kind of reminded me of the guy who says, it hurts when I do this. Well, then don't do this. I mean, it's like, do you have any need to be swimming out alone into the ocean? No. Is it a good idea? Well, and he just hated the idea of being restricted in any way. But it wasn't something that had any impact on his life whatsoever, so it would not meet criteria for that specific phobia. Now, in DSM-5, so you don't be, when you're diagnosing, there are a couple of rule outs, okay? That it's, if you're afraid of panic attacks, that's not going to get diagnosed as specific phobia. That's more likely to be a panic disorder. If you're afraid of embarrassment or humiliation, that's more likely to turn out to be social anxiety disorder. Fear of germs. So people, you have to do, always with anxiety, you have to do a good assessment to find out what the person, what's really going on. You need those thoughts and feelings to really get what's happening with the person. But usually, when you explore fear of germs, it actually turns out to be OCD. Because it's not like, I'm trying to think of a situation where a fear of germs would actually be a specific phobia. I guess if there was a picture of a, I don't know, it'd be a stretch. A fear of germs is usually turns out to be OCD. But it doesn't have, and another change with DSM-5 is that with DSM-5, you need to code by the specific stimulus. So you get a separate code if they're afraid of animals, if they're afraid of things in the natural environment like storms or heights or water. Blood and injury phobia is a separate category, and situational like fear of flying, claustrophobia, elevators, fear of highway driving. These are, people get confused. Those are simple, specific phobias. Flying, claustrophobia. You don't have to have a thing that they're afraid of. It can be the situation. And you really need, in order to clarify, you know, is it embarrassment? Is it panic? Also, PTSD is a rule out. If you look at the criteria for PTSD, if the person meets criteria for panic disorder, OCD, PTSD, or social anxiety disorder, and that's the thing they're afraid of, it's not going to be a specific phobia. However, 75% of people with specific phobia fear more than one situation or object, and then with DSM-5, you need to code each one separately. Okay, so this is all gotten a little more complicated. Now, it's actually, it's interesting because most people don't come, unless you run an anxiety clinic, most people don't come for treatment just for specific phobias. They might, but what you're going to find, though, is as you do a good evaluation, you may well find that they mention as an aside that they have a fear of flying, or they can't drive the freeway, or they're afraid of heights. And in that case, what I find is once we've dealt with some of the other presenting problems and they've seen how effective cognitive therapy is, then they may be willing to tackle some of their specific phobias as well. Because it's actually, in the U.S., the prevalence is like 7 to 9% of people, and it's interesting because it differs a lot by culture. Asian, African, and Latin American countries have lower rates of specific phobia, and females outnumber males. Now, you know, some of this is a willingness to report, but except for blood injury phobia, which I will get to because that's so different. It's like a totally different animal than the other specific phobias. And in blood injury phobia, it's 50-50 male-female. So,
is the blood injury phobia is a kind of specific phobia?
Yes. Blood injury phobia is a specific phobia. It's really quite different. In many ways, but it is still under the cap. But you'd code it specific phobia, blood injury type, because it is in that category. So, pretty straightforward. What the criteria? You do need to get those thoughts and feelings to be able to be sure that you're diagnosing correctly. And what do we do? So, if you look at the what Jim covered, the basic strategy. Of course, we always start with establishing a collaborative relationship, setting goals. Then early on, you want to do education about anxiety. People have been told, anybody who comes in for a specific phobia has been told for years, probably, that there's nothing to be afraid of, it's silly, you know, and they feel stupid. They feel, often they don't feel like, you know, it's hard for them to admit it. So you want to educate them about how anxiety works, how it gets going, and I often go over that little diagram of, you know, the basics cognitive model of anxiety to show that you get it. Because honestly, phobias do make sense. It just makes sense within their cognitive, behavioral, and emotional structure. I mean, they're afraid for a reason. Sometimes it's hard for them to pinpoint that reason, and you might need to have them imagine they were in the scene. Or say, I never, by the way, collaboration, really key. I don't play games. I don't say, oh, you're snake phobic, here's a snake. It's all collaborative. But I might, if they're really, you know, I might say, just, I'm not going to do this, but just imagine I were to walk out into the hall and bring in a snake. What would run through your mind, you know, and how would you be feeling? So as a way of getting some of those cognitions. So we start by educating and showing them that it does make sense, and we know how to deal with it, because it does make sense, and we do know how to deal with it. Cognitive work, the main cognitive piece is in helping them to get to the point where they're willing to do some type of exposure. Now, I want to be very clear. Exposure is a key element of treating phobias. And you cannot do phobias just cognitively. And you can sit and talk about it till you turn purple. You are not really treating it if you don't include some type of exposure. Even Freud, you cannot treat a phobia without the person being exposed to the fear stimulus. So we do cognitive work. We do a lot of cognitive work, because if a person is truly terrified of a stimulus, then they're not going to be willing to do the exposure. So we need to understand what they're telling themselves about it, evaluate the risk and their abilities to cope. We do cognitive work, but the key is exposure. And one of the great cognitive tools that we have with phobias is imagery. So imagining, you can't always have every phobic stimulus in your office at all times, but imagining can be really useful. You can use imagery for assessment. So imagine I were to bring out a snake, and, you know, just picture the scene and spell it out really clearly, and what's going through your mind, how are you feeling? Now, also, imagery is very key to one of the first, possibly the first, behavioral treatment that was developed, which is systematic desensitization. Now, a lot of times this term is used wrong, so I want to get it clear, because at least if you're going to be talking about this stuff, let's not look dumb and let's know how you're using your term. So, technically speaking, and you'll hear it used differently, but technically speaking, systematic desensitization is done only in imagery. It's all imagery, and it's only done gradually. It does not involve experiencing high levels of anxiety. So what you do is you build a hierarchy. This is small steps of images. So let's just say a person's afraid of elevators, and you're going to do systematic desensitization. That means it's going to be gradual, and it's going to be in imagery. Okay? You're going to help them develop step-by-step going from 0 to 100 increasingly anxiety-provoking images. So they might imagine seeing the word elevator on a piece of paper. That might be their 5, a little anxiety-provoking. They might imagine watching an elevator open and close. That might be a 20. Then have them, you know, and have them imagine different steps and get a sense of what would be the highest, most scary thing, which might be riding an elevator to the top of Terminal Tower, or if you can get, it's hard to get people to pay you, but this is all in imagery, so you could have them be up at the top of the Empire State Building or the CNN Tower, imagining, okay? And so what you do with systematic desensitization, you teach the person good relaxation training. You help the person develop the skills to get very relaxed, and you've built this hierarchy, and please, make it individual. Don't pull a hierarchy out of the book. Every single person is different, and what might be 100 for one, it's like, oh, you know, they're not nervous about Terminal Tower because they live in Cleveland. That doesn't scare them, but boy, the CNN, you gotta make it individual. So you teach good relaxation. You have a nice step-by-step-by-step hierarchy. More steps the better, little, medium, big. Then you get the person in your office really relaxed. A recliner is really useful. It's funny because when I first came to Cleveland to straight out of postdoc, straight out of training with Beck, they brought me to Cleveland to start a phobia clinic. And I thought, first thing I'm going to do is get lots of recliners because, you know, systematic desensitization. I ended up with one, and to be honest, I don't use it that much, but I was ready. So you get them very relaxed, and then you have them imagine their little 5 or their little 2 level until, and they, you have it, you know, so they'll raise their finger if they start to get anxious, and then you back them, go back to the relaxation scene, and then you keep going back and forth and back and forth. Imagine a little. If they get anxious, they go back to relaxation, then go back to the scene until they can imagine their 5 without being anxious, and then you move up to the 10, and same thing. And it's very systematic. It's one of the places they get the term. All imagery, all gradual. Person, you work really hard so that the person never gets more than, say, a 3 out of 10 or a 30, you know, doesn't get anxious because you're moving back to a relaxing scene. You had a question?
So if you want to individualize the therapy and you want to create a hierarchy of imagery, are you using, are you just throwing out examples of the patient and then...
Oh, it's guided discovery. Don't throw out examples. You ask the person. So,
but is that how you build the hierarchy?
Yep.
So you're getting their feedback from them.
So what I normally do if I'm building a hierarchy in the office, and some of this we do as homework because it can take a while. And to be honest, this whole thing is really tedious, okay? You might be able to tell from my tone of voice and then you go... Okay, but it works, okay? So to make a hierarchy, I want to get at least 3 points before I send it home for homework. And my favorite way to do a hierarchy is to have little note cards, index cards. And so you can put the item, imagining the word elevator, on the front side, and on the back you can put a 5, you know, the number out of 100. And I have them imagine what's something that would cause just a teensy little bit of anxiety if you were to imagine it. And what would be the most scary, upsetting thing you can possibly imagine? And then, you know, what's something that would be kind of in the middle? And if they have those three, if they have those 3 steps, they usually can fill in, you know, a little, you know. Now, I'd rather, I you know, so you figure at increments of five, you're going to have at least 20 cards. But hey, the more the better. So, for example, you know, they could vary in their, this is all imagination, right? It's just how they expect to feel when they imagine this thing. You know, it could be time of day could vary, who, whether they're alone or with somebody, you know. You can, I mean, it's not that hard to come up with 20 or more little sets. Does that answer?
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is the imagery exposure takes place after you do all the exploring through the guided discovery about what's the worst could happen and all
that? You build a hierarchy. Now, this is for classic systematic desensitization, okay? You build the hierarchy first.
Okay.
And then you start in the office, so you can make sure they're doing it right. You also teach them relaxation training first, okay, and make sure they can get relaxed. And then you do a step, imagine, get a little anxious, go back and forth in the office. Once you've done it with them in the office some, and they're getting it, mm-hmm, which you want to make sure, that's why you start in the office, because sometimes they'll, you know, do it differently, or they're not, you know, they don't follow the rules. Once they're getting it, they can then move and do, preferably on a daily basis, a session each day at home.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the in vivo exposure is a very crucial part of.
It's not in vivo.
No.
There's no in vivo. Imagery.
Imagery, okay.
Imagery, okay. We're still talking
just
systematic desensitization, okay?
Okay.
And, yeah.
I didn't get that part of the card.
Okay, so you're making a hierarchy. So you can just make a list.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a list 5, 10, 15, 20.
Mm-hmm.
But on a piece of paper, I mean, if you put it on your computer, if you just make a list, but then maybe when they actually go to do it, they realize, oh, wait, I was wrong. That's really hard. That's not a 10, that's a 20. Then you can move them around. You can, you know, so you can shuffle, you know, you can mix up the cards and rearrange them easily. That's why I like the cards. You don't have to do the cards. You can do any kind of list. But the cards are just easy. It's a tangible thing that you can play around with. Okay? Now, the idea is then, and this has been studied because this was the first behavioral treatment. So we're talking a long time ago, even before I was doing this. So there's a lot of research. And it works. If you stick it out, and go and imagine and relax and imagine and relax, and you build up and you actually follow through, the person will. And what they're doing is people are conditioned. Their body has learned to react with anxiety to these stimuli. And if you do this systematically and go step by step, the person is, you're breaking that conditioning. So the person ends up imagining that they're in the top situation and they're still relaxed. And in fact, it does end up generalizing to real life. They are better able to then go do stuff in real life, not in your recliner with their finger up and down. Okay, so that's systematic desensitization. Okay? Now, you can do that. It is tedious. Now, you can do that, or if they have a fear of elevators, I have an elevator right down the hall. We can do it in imagery and do systematic desensitization, or we can do what's called in vivo, which means in real life. So, systematic desensitization does work. And it's great for things where it's really hard to expose in real life. So I had a woman came in the summer, and she was very fearful of ski lifts. And I didn't have access to ski lifts in the summer. I had another woman who was terrified of Hawaii. And for the life of me, I couldn't get her to pay to send me with her to Hawaii. So we, you know, using image, I tried. So using imagery in when there are situations that you really don't have access to, it works fine. But if I've got an elevator right here, I could do it systematic desensitization in imagery, or we can do it in real life still with the hierarchy, but actually in real life. And then it's even more likely and easier to generalize to real life elevators, okay? So you could imagine an elevator opening and closing, or you could walk down the hall and watch the elevator open and closing. So that's one difference between systematic desensitization and in vivo exposure. Now, the thing about in vivo exposure is that you can do that gradually with a hierarchy, step by step, keeping the person calm, just like systematic desensitization, but the only difference is it's real. You're actually experiencing the item. And we've done, I used to bring my dogs in for the dog phobics. You know, if that happens to work, you know, you can do all kinds of different, again, if you can find a way to do it systematically, you can do it gradually, step by step, in vivo, which is in vivo exposure. It's not systematic desensitization, but it's in vivo exposure. But you can also do the total opposite. So the opposite of gradual exposure, whether in imagery or in vivo, is flooding. And it looks and feels very, very different. And it also works. So flooding is, forget the hierarchy, forget the relaxation, go right to the 100. Okay? Go for the terminal tower. Again, I don't get people to pay for me to go to the CNN tower or any place that's not local, so, you know, terminal tower will do. It's a celebrity. And flooding now, here's flooding also works. It's a totally opposite in the experience, but it works just as well, and in some ways a lot quicker. And but people will say to you, and be careful about this, people will say, oh no, I've done that. I tried going to Terminal Tower. And I got, and if you think about our model, the little cognitive diagram, yeah, oh my goodness, I tried going to the Terminal Tower. I went, I got more and more anxious. I got so anxious that I screamed like a chicken and ran home. So flooding doesn't work, is what they'll say to me. But that's not flooding. What they just did was avoidance. They got, and that's how phobias are born. You get anxious, and this really can be one-shot learning, one-trial learning. You have a bad experience. You know, you get anxious, you're exposed to something or other, you get anxious, you're terrified, and you leave. And it feels great to leave. It feels wonderful. Oh, I'm free. So you have just created the likelihood that the next time you're going to be anxious, you're going to run, you're going to feel better, and your phobia is going to get worse and worse. So people will say, oh, I've done flooding. The difference is that when you're doing flooding, and this is all collaborative, and it's not done in session one, but with flooding, what you do is you put the person agrees and gets into their top, if possible, situation and stays there. And they stay there, hell or high water. They stay until the anxiety comes down. They stay long enough so that the feelings peak and pass. Okay? And what happens with systematic or any kind of gradual exposure, you're in the high anxiety situations, but you're no longer anxious. You're relaxed while imagining or being in the 100. So you're in the top situations and you're not anxious. Flooding ends up the same way. You're in, you know, you've stayed long enough so that you're in that high anxiety situation, but you've habituated. Your anxiety has peaked and come down, and you're there, and you're no longer anxious. Now, it feels totally different, and it's going to feel totally different to you, the therapist, okay? But does the basic The basic differences make sense?
Can you do, you can also do the flooding and imagery as well?
You can do flooding and imagery. It wouldn't be systematic desensitization. But you can do flooding and imagery. I mean, again, if you can do exposure to the real situation, it's going to be more likely to generalize and more powerful. But again, like, I couldn't do Hawaii, I couldn't do ski lifts. Mm-hmm. There are lots of things I can't really do. So now, they both work. And key, when you're doing flooding, the goal is to get as anxious as possible. I mean, people can hover at a 90 for a very long time. So we don't want them to relax. We don't teach relaxation. We don't teach, you know, we don't do cognitive restructuring while flooding. With flooding, you want the anxiety up, 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 so it will habituate, okay? So you don't, and they can do, you can do entire specific phobia treatment with zero relaxation. If you're doing flooding, you may never do relaxation. You have to do some cognitive work, because if the person's really afraid, they're not going to go. If they really believe it's dangerous, they would be stupid. And I would not want them to just blindly follow me if they're, you know, really think they're going to die, or, you know, truly believe it's dangerous. So you've got to help them get to a point where they get that this is something that they're willing to do, okay? So you have a cognitive piece, but you don't have to do relaxation. You do if you're going to do systematic desensitization, but with flooding, you don't need any coping whatsoever, okay? But it gets logistically complicated. Now, how do you choose, okay? Person comes in and they have a fear of elevators, and it's interfering with their life. They're going to lose their job because they have to go up 16 flights of stairs, and they're always late to work, and they're always sweaty, and they stink. I don't, you know. Causing real problems for them. How do you decide to go gradual or flooding? Well, there's some specific contraindications, okay? So if the person, and believe me, I get this, the person has a fear of flying, and they're flying in 10 days to Hawaii, I don't have time for systematic desensitization. We do not have time. If they really want to get someplace, and it's that, if there's not time, you have to go for flooding, okay? Because systematic desensitization takes time. If they happen to know they'll never, they, if they tell you, I'm not going to follow through on homework, I don't follow through, you can't, I never follow through on anything in my life, probably not a good candidate for systematic desensitization, because you got to do it on a daily basis, you got to do a lot. On the other hand, let's say the person just had a triple bypass, and their doctor told them, and this is a key, this tells you it's a bad idea for the person to get anxious if the doctor says no sex. Okay? They don't often say that. People say, oh, but anxiety is bad for me. Well, most people, if you can have good sex, okay, not just mediocre sex, good sex, you know, exciting sex, if your body can handle exciting sex, your body can handle anxiety and panic, okay? But if you've just had a triple bypass and the doctor says, no sex, you gotta know, you know, we gotta be very, very careful, you don't do flooding, okay? That, I mean, I had, and doctors, actually, I will, before doing flooding, I don't just send a release to their physician. We send a release and try to get medical records on every patient that comes in the door. But if I'm gonna do flooding, I'm going to talk to their doctor, and I'm going to say, is there any reason that it would be medically dangerous for this person to get very, very anxious? Because for a person to reach their 100, we are talking anxious. And be prepared, anxiety is contagious. If you're in the room with a person who is hysterically anxious, you feel it. It is tiring, and believe me, you deserve to get paid for that time. So if it's medically dangerous, now sometimes I'm more conservative than the doctors. I saw one guy, he was grossly overweight, and he had uncontrollable high blood pressure and uncontrolled diabetes. And his doctor said, oh, it's fine, you know, he can be. I wasn't. With the uncontrolled high blood pressure, one of my rules of thumb as a mental health professional is I do not get paid enough for me to be worried about my patients. If I have to wonder if my patient's going to be all right, I'm not going to do it. So with the doc said it was fine, I said, no, we're going to go gradual. It just, I need to be comfortable as well. Things like pregnancy are interesting. And most docs when I've talked to, they say, look, this person's fears are causing them so much stress that doing flooding in a controlled environment for a limited period of time is better for the baby than this chronic stress the person is putting themselves through. So, but if the doc said, no, it's high-risk pregnancy, we don't want this person to be anxious, I don't have to do flooding because gradual also works. Okay? Now, I saw one guy. He said, it was elevator. He said, well, the last time he was in an elevator, he got so anxious that he punched the person next to him. I'm not doing flooding with this gentleman. Does not seem like a good idea. So, there's some reasons why you choose one or the other. But if there's no contraindication, the best thing you can do is be collaborative. Lay out the options and let the patient pick. And I love collaboration. And what I love about letting the patient pick, and you lay it out honestly. Okay, this one, you're comfortable the whole time. You never get anxious. We do step by step by step by step. But it is tedious. It is boring. You're going to have to follow through on a daily basis. Or flooding, you will be extremely, extremely anxious. And we will keep you extreme. You will need to agree that you're going to stay no matter how anxious you get. So it's going to be emotionally much harder. You know, I lay it out. No, don't pull any punches. But then when they've made the choice, you really cut down on the whining. I mean, you really do. But this is so boring. They don't even bother to say that because they know they chose it. Right? And it's like, but this is so hard. Yeah, I know. It's really hard. So, collaboration, if you can get, if there's no other reason, no time constraints, no health constraints, no safety constraints, let them pick. Yeah.
So for systematic, for homework, are they doing imagery on their own, or?
Yes, if you're doing systematic desensitization or in vivo, graded in vivo exposure, you do that. You start it in the office so that you may, and you do maybe the 5, maybe up to 10, depends how much you can do. And then they have the hierarchy, so they go home and they do it every day. They keep doing it, and they come back in and they do some more. Now with flooding, and that raises a good point. Usually, if you're going to do true flooding, if at all possible, you want to do the first exposure at least with them. And the reason is, as Jim probably mentioned this morning, one thing about anxiety is it interferes with concentration. Okay, so when people are really anxious, they can't concentrate, they don't think as clearly. So you send someone out to do flooding, and the goal is to get them up to 100 and stay, they're by themselves, they get anxious, they forget, what the hell am I doing here? This feels horrible, I'm going home. I am not going, and I'm going to say this very strongly, I am not willing to do a procedure with my patients that is likely to make their problem worse. It is not ethical. It's not appropriate. So I will not set up a flooding with a patient if I think there is any significant chance that they are going to bail. Okay? So I'm going to say that I lay it on the line. It's like, so how are you going to, what are you going to do if you start shaking? We talk about when they've been anxious before, but what if you're even more anxious? You know, how are you going to convince yourself to stay? What are you going to do? And I make it clear, leaving is not an option, or we're not going to do it. And do you know, I have never had a patient bail in the middle of a flooding. And if they did, what did we just do? They got anxious, they got even more anxious than usual, and then they avoided. Guess what? I've made their phobia worse. That's not what I'm paid for. So I'm not going to do it. But so this is not something we do in session one. We talk the options, we spell it out, we build the program, we might, you know, we make sure the person knows what they're getting into and they're prepared to do it and they're ready to stick it out. Yes.
I just want to clarify this. Is the flooding is something that before I send out my patient to do it
or go with them?
If going with them is not an option, is that something you would be doing during session imagery? Prepare them doing the imagery.
You can prepare with some flooding imagery. You might need to do the whole thing in imagery if it's a ski lift in the summer or whatever. So it could be, and you could do imagery to help prepare them. But if at all possible, I want to be there when they're doing the actual flooding. Now, this can be a logistical nightmare, I gotta tell you, okay? Because how do we know in advance how long it's gonna take them to habituate? Let's say I have a 50-minute session and we have to drive to Terminal Tower and ride the elevators up and down. A 50-minute session isn't going to cut it. And believe me, if you're accompanying someone who's doing a flooding, it's work. You deserve to get paid, and you deserve to get paid portal to portal. So, rule of thumb, 3 hours. It's pretty safe for most people. Okay? Now, most insurance companies do not want to pay for a 3-hour session. Okay? Some will, because this is a documented, highly appropriate and effective treatment to flooding. And so there will, I know, the VA at times has agreed, but please don't just bill a 3-hour session and expect to get paid for it. You get approval in advance. Workers' comp has approved. I mean, it depends. If you can make a case, you might, but most of the time it's going to be 1 hour might get pay covered and the rest is going to be out of pocket. And so you sometimes have to juggle things that we do. For example, I might start the patient on their flooding, and then they have strict instructions, and then I call to check in on them in between my other patients, stay, and then I'll check in. It takes a lot of creativity to find what's really going to expose them to what they're afraid of, and what's going to actually be logistically practical. You might be able to train a trusted person. Be careful that this person doesn't have a dog in that race. The person doesn't have reasons to keep them phobic, and that this is someone who will really be helpful, supportive, not in saying, oh, you'll be fine, but saying, well, let's get that anxiety higher. So you take some training, but you might be able to send them with someone you've trained to go with them. And certainly it's usually not practical to do too many of the floodings in with you in person. But once they've done a really good one, usually, and one is not enough, by the way. It's not like they're cured. Then they need to go do the same thing over and over, but usually they can do it without you. Yes.
I'm trying to visualize myself doing that with my client. I'm having a hard time kind of, because you're saying you don't give them, you don't train them with a coping skill.
All right.
So when they're at the peak of their anxiety, what would you do?
You what say, great. No, they say, but, you know, I'm sweating, my heart's racing, and you're like, good, good, let's keep it going. Yeah, and now, what we don't, what you do not have to do, there used to be, I'm blocking on the name, there's a reason, because it was horrible. They used to have something even more extreme where, let's just say a person's afraid of elevators because they're afraid they'll suffocate and die. Well, they used to not just expose them to riding the elevators, but they would have them imagine or tell them, yes, the air is running, you know, they'd have them imagine that, yes, you're suffocating and dying. So they'd go to the extreme fear and have them, I mean, it was, honestly, now that takes, I thought, there's research on it. It actually could work, but to me, I think you would have to be a sadist to really keep going. I feel bad enough when I'm deliberately making my patients more anxious. But remember, they're bought into this, they're ready, they get it. But when you're doing a flooding like this, there's no chit-chat, and you have to be very clear. This is not a social trip downtown, okay, or to the mall. They can use the mall for all kinds of exposures. But this is not a social event, and you can stay focused, and it's like you ask them, okay, where's your anxiety in your body? You know, can you get it up? I mean, you know, if they're saying, well, you know, I'm only at a 8 out of 10 or an 80 out of 100, you can use whatever scale makes sense to you. And it's like, you know, my heart's pounding. Well, while you're in the elevator, should we have you run in place? How can we get your heart pounding even harder? You know, how can we get it up even higher? That's what you're doing. No coping. It's not like you'll be fine. Calm down. You're not going to die. You don't say, yes, you will die. You don't say, no, you won't die. And you don't have them do deep breathing to calm down. You say, maybe you have them pant. You could have them hyperventilate. But usually you don't need to because it's hard. If you picked a good flooding, if it's hard enough, they're going to get there. And so, but yes, it's strictly business.
So if they're saying, I can't breathe, I feel like
Hold your breath. Let's hold your breath.
Okay.
Hold your breath. Okay. You don't need to go for it. Hold your breath. Let's make it worse. Let's get it up. How high are you? Let's get it. It's gloomy. It's challenging. But it is also effective. And I'll give you an example of one of my favorites. So woman was she had all kinds of claustrophobia, being trapped issues, okay? And she thought a great exposure for her would be to go on the Good Time boat. So there's a boat in Lake Erie. And believe me, people pay money for this tour. They're not going to come back because you're screaming and you're anxious, really. They're not going to come back for you. So you are trapped. And it's like, I'm thinking of a 3-hour tour, but I think I'm thinking of Gilligan's Island. I think it's 2 hours. So what we did is, and she thought that would be her 100, and that was the most convenient 100 we could think of, you know, for her, that she'd have no way back. And so we went in, you know, and she said in order to be able to do it, you know, we were going to do it together, okay? And by the way, I try to warn them. I say, you know, don't wear makeup. Wear comfortable clothes. You are going to be a wreck. This is going to be exhausting. Let's be ready for it. Well, she didn't listen. She wore makeup, you know. She was seeing me, and I'm an authority figure. She didn't want to look bad. Okay, so we go down, and as we're getting ready to get the tickets, which of course she was going to pay for, she said, you know, I feel so much better with you here. You know, I feel very comfortable having you with me. And I'm like, now I didn't just say, you know, I stopped and I said collaboratively, now wait. The whole point is to get as anxious as possible. And you're saying that my being here is going to interfere with your getting as anxious as possible. Is that true? And she said, yeah. And I said, so to save time and not have to redo this, would you be willing to do it on your own? And if you did it on your own, would your anxiety be higher? Oh, yeah. She said, okay, I'll do it on my own. So she gets on the boat. I go shopping. Okay, I come back in 2 hours, and this is so classic for someone doing flooding. So I'm waiting for her, coming off the boat, and she comes off, and she looks horrible. There's mascara running all down her face. She obviously has been trying. Her hair is all disheveled. She's like this, and she's walking down the gangplank, and she looks at me, and she goes, and that's what happens. It's so hard, but it's so satisfying because people get it. They're there in the situation, and it's just they've burned out. They're not anxious anymore. And there's this amazing satisfaction that I did it. And that's just to me that I wish I had that on video because it was just perfect moment, okay? And that's what... And if you know, all kinds of things, if the person doesn't get anxious, then you're missing the point. And that's where good assessment is so important. Because somebody might say, you know, they're afraid of elevators, but what they're really afraid of is being closed in. And so if it's a glass elevator, it's not, you know, there's all kinds of reasons that they could do. Pick something that's not going to make them anxious. And then you're not doing a flooding. So, now... It takes, I mean, really, you have to be willing to put up with the, you know, with the anxiety. And rule of thumb, when people get anxious, they talk faster and their voices get higher pitched. And I have seen this. I've seen this in my own videos. Okay? What happens is they're getting higher pitched and faster and you're getting higher pitched and faster. And you get... So... When I'm working and when I'm doing flooding, I'm not the one doing the flooding. When I'm working with an anxious patient, maybe someone who can't even sit down, they're pacing, I have to make a conscious effort, slow down my speech, lower my voice, which gets too high anyway, maybe even softer, you know, so I'm staying calm. And I'm saying, and if they say, which they will, I don't want to do this. I want to leave. Sorry, you can't leave. I'm not going to restrain them. I'm not going to hold them back, but I am very firm. We've talked about this. You're not going to make this worse. You agreed to do this. You are staying. You are staying, and you're going to keep going. What can we do to get that anxiety higher? Now, so exposure, very important. Now, here's the thing, though I've talked about the classics. Classic systematic desensitization, there's in vivo, which can be gradual or flooding, imagery can be flooding. Okay, we have all the classics. Then it turns out that a whole bunch of this stuff doesn't necessarily really matter. So you could take your hierarchy, you could take your little note cards, throw them in the air, mix them up, and still do the exposure, it still works. You don't have to keep the person totally calm. You don't have to do flooding with their 100. Let's just say they're not willing to agree to the 100, but they start with 50. All right, we can live with that. We start with 50. As long as it gets them anxious, it doesn't have to be all the way. The keys are, and I'm going to show you, I have a copy of a hierarchy here, and we're going to talk about these general guidelines for exposure all the time. It's not even 100% clear that the fear needs to come down at any one time. The key is, person has to experience the situation, and it has to be repeated. So you have to have exposure, whether it's imagery or in vivo, step by step, or flooding, or in between. Because what the more recent, and it's very interesting, and it's very new, Michelle Kraske has been spearheading a lot of this research, because it's not that the fear is actually eliminated, okay? It's not that the person never gets afraid again. They need to learn that they can experience the fear or be in that situation and have a different response, not running, not hiding. And so, and what turns out to be the best, the most important thing is to challenge their expectancies. So if they expect to get, you know, always be anxious with the stimulus, and you show them they can be with the stimulus and not anxious, that's a change. It's a surprise. So doing things too systematically may actually be holding us back a little bit. So we don't have to be perfect. Now, what you do have to get, you have to have some type of exposure. Absolutely. Everyone agrees with that. And it has to be collaborative. You have to have buy-in. So if the person wants and really wants to do little step by little step, you can't push flooding. You can't coerce, you really need to have their buy-in. This is why it's especially important to keep these things in mind when you're dealing with children. So, you know, I mean, people say, oh, fine, you're afraid of water, I'll just throw you in the deep end. That is not treatment. That's not therapy. That's trauma, you know? But I'll tell you, if you can, kids are amazing. Kids are just amazing. Kids are willing to do stuff that their parents, who also often may be anxious to, and maybe actually tell them, well, you don't do that, or you don't need to do that. Kids are game if they get it. But if you have any question about whether you truly have consent, okay, if the person's maybe dull, normal IQ, doesn't really know what they're getting into, if it's a child who's not really getting it, if the person's so anxious they're not listening to you and they're just like, whatever you say, don't do flooding. So you don't have to. The gradual approaches do work. And so use your head. But I'll tell you, treatment there is it was 20 years, there are probably 30 years of research, probably more. Because they were doing research on this before, not before I was born, mind you, but before I was practicing. So there's long-term studies. This stuff really works. But there's no magic. I mean, it doesn't have to be exactly. I often can't get the 100 on an early flooding, you know. And I never do gradual exposure starting with a 5. It's too boring. I can't stand starting at a 5. You're willing to start. Where are you willing to start? You're willing to start at the 20. Let's start at the 20 and build up from there. Too boring. I don't have the patience. Yeah.
So are you doing the systematic desensitization, like the whole session after session?
Usually, I'm sure in some of the research studies, I'm sure that's what you do. I don't have the patience. So I spend a lot of time there's significant prep time to make sure the person's making a conscious choice and they get it, and if it's systematic desensitization, they have their hierarchy and whatever. It's relevant to their fears, not some book. And then I will, we'll start out and we'll do a significant part of the first session. Then I send them in homework. Then they come back and with a log of what they've done and how anxious and how relaxed they got. And then we talk about problems, and then I might do some more. Once they're getting it, and if they're doing it at home consistently, we're more problem solving, and then I might do a little, or if they're avoiding the next step, or there's a problem, but no, I don't do an entire, now, one could, and I'm sure in the strict studies, that's what they do, but you don't need to. And it's not even clear, that they always, even with flooding, they don't always have to come. You certainly don't have to go from 100 to 0. You do not. Even when you're flooding. I like having them come, sticking it out until they come down some. Some research is showing that if they're willing to keep doing it long enough, it still works even if it doesn't come down. But if it doesn't come down at all, how do you know what they're doing if they're seeing this as a success, as a fit? So I think it's touchy and it's really new research. But the goal, really, when you know you've gotten someplace, when they get that they can do this and they can feel the feelings and they're willing to go and do it in real life. So it doesn't have to be perfect. And in fact, I think you can mess with it. If you really want to do systematic, though, if that's what they want and that's what you've agreed to, then you better do it systematic. And if you've agreed to flooding, it doesn't have to be at 100, but you need to, you need to practice with yourself. Make sense? Yes.
So for example, for the dog phobia, how would you do the systemic desensitization with the? How would you have it that start at 20? Start at 20, for the client? How would you?
If they're afraid of dogs, first you have to do it with the person. One person's 20 might be seeing a picture of a dog.
Just a picture.
Systematic desensitization. You don't look at actual pictures of dogs. You imagine pictures of dogs. It's silly, but yeah, it might be pictures of dogs. It might be seeing a dog from, all the way down the hall. I mean, we've done some amazing things there. And I'm telling you, you got to be prepared for what happened there. I'm going to give one more example, and then we'll have a break. This was in a hospital clinic where it was one of my supervisees, but I was in with my patient, and so a woman had a bird phobia, which was really a problem because she worked downtown, and she couldn't go to work because of the pigeons, okay? So she actually got her husband to go and bought a bird, poor bird. But I'm not sure how birds feel about women screaming because we had been, she was doing it. She was doing in vivo exposure in the office, and this woman screamed at the top of her lungs for 3 hours.
Oh, what?
As we were trying to see other patients. And then I'm like, are you murdering people in here? She actually did great. She was totally game. So they started way down the hall and then moved her closer. And she's terrified. And she is, everybody's different with their anxiety. And some people are screamers. I've never gotten arrested. And we'll talk about some of the other things crazy things we do. I've never gotten arrested. But I have had security guards, like a terminal tower, come up and say, what the hell are you doing? Because I'm standing there, we're riding up and down. It can look a little suspicious, and people are crying. And usually in public, they don't scream quite as, but they can obviously. And people will come up, surprisingly few. But sometimes people will come up and say, is everything all right? Oh, yeah. She's supposed to cry, don't worry. Then they got used to me. That's what will happen. They get used to you, although I can never, maybe long enough has passed, but I was told not to go back to Club Isabella because of the exposures I was doing in the restaurant because it was right across the street from the clinic. Some people understand it more than others. But, yes. All right, break time, 6 minutes. Be here. Oh, wait, I didn't count. Do we 6 minutes. I was preparing.